Oh, the horns don't.
And everything that we do every day, we want to be a champ.
Get your mind right and let's go. Do the little things. Win every day.
It's the same place they play football.
Every team with an attitude.
Alabama.
I don't give a shit who we're playing.
Don't let the guys play against and make his ass quit. That's our framework. That's our MO as a team.
Richardson breaks free on the sideline. End zone.
This is a mauling, folks, a mauling.
Fear the tide, honey badger.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. Tom, we expected LSU to give us a fight and to be a measure for how good we really are. Seems we fared well on both of those counts. You agree?
You know, I think the whole stadium was a little bit curious about that at the beginning of the game. I mean, this is always a great game. In watching the replay, I heard Gary Danielson say that, you know, that one of these two teams have been ranked number one in the country five out of the last eight times they've played each other. So obviously the whole country was watching this. You know, these are two big teams, a big rivalry game. I think LSU tried to catch us on our heels early. I mean, they tried to go pick on Deion Blue and pick on the safeties to see if they were communicating properly in the back end on that big throw. And then they tried to do a lot of hurry up offense mixed in early. And so it seems like at the beginning, you know, we were just not in sync on defense. And fortunately for us, they missed some opportunities early, or I think this game might have had a little different outcome. You know, it would have been more in doubt later in the game had LSU not made some miscues early.
They were in a little more rhythm, especially offensively, to start the game. But, you know, you're right. They had a couple of miscues, but it seemed that they also had a couple of big plays. And so they kind of counterbalanced. On a whole, you know, people kind of set it up as the tale of two halves and, you know, the LSU half and the Alabama half. And I don't know that I see it that way. You know, we led at halftime. They had just a couple of plays that put them in position to score. And I think before each of those, you know, certainly their touchdown, maybe the field goal as well. You know, Mosley almost picked off balls. And so the first half could have gone different ways if they had not fumbled, but it certainly could have gone other ways too if Mosley was able to hold on the ball a little bit. So on balance, I thought the first half was pretty representative. We moved the ball very well, especially after the first quarter, and we had the lead. And then, of course, we certainly amplified that performance in the second half. I'm very pleased with the showing against a real game LSU Tiger squad.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say it was a pure tale of two halves, but I would definitely concur with those that say we were outplayed in the first half. And so I might choose to disagree with you that you know, even Saban said in his post game, you know, that second half, you know, might have been the best half of football all year, but that we were really on our heels. And, you know, a lot of articles spoke about the halftime adjustments, and it spoke about the running backs, you know, motioning out into the slots and the linebackers being a little bit out of sync as far as communicating. There were several times in the first half that we were still kind of motioning people around and still motioning to each other with hand signals, and they were snapping the ball, and they were out physicaling us early on. I mean, I would say that on that first series they had, they should have, of course, scored a touchdown. And then the very next series, you know, literally they snapped the ball. You know, the center snaps the ball in the shotgun when Zach Mettenberger is wanting to walk up to the line of scrimmage, and we get a gimme fumble at the 25-yard line, and we can only kick a field goal. And so, you know, early on, we could have been behind by double digits, which could have changed the complexity of this game. So I don't question that we outplayed them in the second half, but I do think they outplayed us in the first half.
See, I disagree with that. I soundly, you know, disagree with that. I Saban's right. That may be the best second half. I don't have issue with that. I think we played somewhat poorly in the first quarter, but again, you know, we matched their point total for the game. We matched that in the first half. If that's a down half, then that's a pretty good down half. We came out a little flat in the first quarter, and they had some success. But you know, we're always motioning and hand signaling on the defense, especially in such a loud game. And then the volume and the crowd participation, I think, contributed to that missed snap, you know, that they had. Again, we dropped two interceptions. So, you know, they fumbled the ball. We dropped two interceptions, you know, on balance. It wasn't. I'm not saying we played as well in the first half as we played in the second half, but I don't think we played nearly as bad in the first half. That first quarter, I might grant you the first quarter, but not the full first half.
Well, even the second quarter, though, David. I mean, they come down. You know, they start at their 25-yard line with 5 minutes left in the second quarter, and they methodically march down the field, passing the ball at will for first down after first down after first down, and score a touchdown to make it a 17-14 ball game, and knowing that they're going to get the ball to start the second half. And so, I mean, they even, in my opinion, they were giving us blow for blow, and they're the one, I guess I'll say it to you this way. They were matching us blow for blow, and they had two turnovers in the first half that we didn't have, and it was only a 17-14 ball game. So they're only down by three at Alabama with two turnovers, and they get the ball to start the second half. So how can they not have won the first half?
Well, scoreboard says different.
Yeah, scoreboard says 17-14, but they had two turnovers. And so you turn the ball over on the opponent's, goal line, and you give it away on your 25-yard line. You hold the team to a field goal when you turn it over on your 25. I mean, you know, we can disagree. I just truly feel like they had to go into halftime thinking, we've turned the ball over twice, and we're only down by three, and we get the ball to start the second half.
Sure. Well, of course they would. You know, they're not paying attention if they're not thinking that. I just don't think we played as poorly in the first half as some would position.
I would also definitely disagree. Now, I will disagree with the people, you know, that make the assessment that the fake punt, you know, changed the whole complexity of the game. I truly do not feel like, you know, that was the, you know, I guess I don't buy the spark plug that was the fake punt, because, you know, Saban said, well, at that point, our defense wasn't playing very well. He said, I didn't want to give the ball back to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can talk about this in the special teams as far as the, you know, dissecting the fake punt, but obviously they shifted into punt safe. He was comfortable changing the play. They went with the fake because he didn't want to give the ball back to them.
Right.
And that kind of reminded me of the national championship game in 2009 against Texas, when uncharacteristically Saban does a fake punt deep in his territory because he felt like, right now, right this minute, I have got to keep the ball. And so I feel like Saban sensed that this could turn badly for us right here if we don't get points right now with the football.
Right.
So I thought that was very telling, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how uncharacteristic is it for Nick Saban to do a fake punt at his 40-yard line when it's a 3-point ball game at the beginning of the second half?
You know, and I think you'll agree with this. I don't think it's as uncharacteristic as the media wants to play it out, because he doesn't do it every game, and he doesn't, you know, it's not even a once a month thing, but he'll do it. And, you know, like you said, he'll do it on, you know, in big positions. You know, I think we did it against Notre Dame. I think we did, you know, we did it here in this game. I think we did it against LSU last year. You know, there's instances where, you know, you mentioned Texas. There's instances where we'll bring it out. It's on the fringes of his personality, but I don't think it's completely out of character. He just doesn't have a riverboat gambler mentality, you know, sort of persona. But he'll bring these out, you know, on occasion. And I wasn't altogether surprised that we did it.
Here's what I'll say. The last time they did it before this game was the SEC championship game against Georgia.
There you go.
And in that game, being at that game in person, I had the same feeling at that point in the game as I did in this point in the game, that it was a pivotal moment, that if we give the ball back to them, they're going to score. And I remember thinking, Georgia's got the momentum. If we give the ball back to them, they're going to score. And so to me, just off the top of my head, I think of Texas, I think of Georgia, and I think of this game. And all three moments of time, I think, is he a riverboat gambler? Of course he's not.
Right.
But he is strategic enough in all three of those moments in time to say, right now, my team, we're not in sync. It's not, you know, it's not going right. our way. This could get away from us here.
No.
And so I'm going to make this attempt right now, as ballsy it could be. Texas at my 20 and LSU at my 40. I don't care where it is on the field. We're going to damn do it.
Yeah. And here's where we're triangulating on maybe the first point that we'll completely agree on. He doesn't do it to show off here. Look at my new trick play.
No,
he doesn't do it with that approach, but he takes the more holistic approach of, I need to hold on to this ball, you know, and maybe that can be a spark for the offense. I need to hold on to this ball. Like you said, in this moment of the game, we need a momentum shift, and here's how I can get it.
Yes, absolutely.
So it is very strategic as opposed to, you know, hey, let me show you this trick play that I've got.
Yes, and I will say that while I think Saban, you know, so for all of those reasons, that's why I feel like he did it.
Yep.
But I don't think that was a turning point in the game. I think the turning point in the game started early with the miscue with the fumble by the fullback and the miscue of the fumble on the botched snap to Mettenberger in the shotgun. And then it just reared its ugly head again in the third quarter. Yep. And so I look at the moment where we have scored after the fake. They have gotten the ball back and we have held them. Okay. Yep. But then after we hold them on the first play of scrimmage at the 29 yard line, okay, AJ rushes for 4 yards outside and literally they have a personal foul hitting him out of bounds, which was thoroughly unnecessary. And you and I talked about how dumb of a play that was.
Yep.
Well, guess what this does? They go from Alabama goes from, because right now it's a 24-17 game, and it goes from being at Alabama's 29 to suddenly it gets moved to the 48 yard line. And so then literally right after that, you know, they have another personal foul play. And I felt like they were just not being, I don't want to say mature, but they were making little silly mistakes like that. That was letting the game get away from them. I just thought that right there, it was like whoever plays the best game from this point forward, it's a 7-point ball game, is going to win. And we played kind of flawlessly and they just kind of self-imploded.
Yeah. I think the weight of, you know, and it's, you know, it's the old sort of axiom that, you know, 3, 4, 5 plays are going to decide the game. And I think it's the weight of those collective plays that turned the balance. And so you mentioned the personal foul. I think that's one of those five. I do think the fake punt is one of those five. In the first, when we scored our second touchdown in the first half, it was the play to O.J. Howard, which in and of itself is a phenomenal play. But the play just before that was a 3rd and 9, and we threw an incomplete pass to Amari Cooper, but they were flagged for a pass interference, which gave us the first down, let us score the touchdown on the very next play. Their fumble, you know, and so that's just off the top. And then if you want to take
personal foul snap, against Kevin Norwood, there was another 15 yards.
Yeah, and so if you take any, you know, sort of, you start to distill that down into, you know, the 3, 4, 5, you take those and they just have a collective weight that just, you know, I hate to use a Fran analogy, but kind of, you know, holding the rope, and then it's just too much weight. You can't hold it any longer. And it just seems a cumulative weight of those events. And then the game just slipped away from them. And then in the second half, you know, look, that may well have been the best second half performance that we've seen, certainly this season. The collective weight, it's, you know, let me just use another analogy. You know, those are in boxing, those are body blows, and, you know, work the body and the head will fall. And that's really what happened in the second half. You know, we worked the body, worked the body, worked the body. And in some of those touchdowns were just, you know, were just blows to the head and you know, eventually knockout shots. So why don't we kind of loop back to offense and you know, we've covered a lot of bases. Why don't we kind of drill down back into the offense? What were some of the things that stood out to you on offense?
Well, first of all, in the first play of the game, you know, we started the 10 or 13 yard line because we had the stupid hold on the kickoff, and the very first play of scrimmage, very first play of the game on offense, we pull steam because, of course, he is our, you know, for all the criticism I've given him in years past, he is the go-to guy on this offensive line now. So we pull him at right guard, and we decide to send him. We don't send him up the between left guard and center. We send him between left tackle and left guard. And on this play, I was just watching Cyrus. And Cyrus and his brother double-team the defensive tackle. And Cyrus is supposed to move up to the linebacker. He loses his balance and falls down, but is able to quickly get up enough to shield the linebacker from TJ, where TJ can make the nice big run. And so what should have been a negative start to the game, we're able to get a big run, get out of that hole, right, and kind of start, you know, start going. And so I just wanted to point that out because we've given Cyrus a little grief earlier in the season. And that's just an example of how this offensive line is just really gelling. And so I thought that he had a good game. And I wanted to point out Austin Shepherd real quick, because granted LSU lost a lot of defensive players, but they still got speed on defense. You know, only one time did AJ take a sack, and that's just because the guy was just unimpeded to the quarterback. And so for us to finish one sack in this game against these kind of athletes, I just thought kudos to the offensive line.
Yeah, I think across the board the offensive line played well. You know, Shepherd graded out as the top performer and was one of the offensive players of the game. You know, I like the way you set up the play, and you know, in that first play, there's a lot of sparks that we could follow on that one. When we talk to special teams, you know, we'll circle back to us starting on the 10 because that's a pet peeve of mine. And then we do rush for, you know, 10, 11, 12 yards on that first play. And we did have some success rushing the ball. But when you talk about, you know, Cyrus, you know, he loses his footing and then pops right back up. If you just want to do a side-by-side comparison of, you know, the athleticism of Cyrus, you know, versus his brother Ari, the easiest way to do that is watch them get off the ground. You know, watch them get up from, you know, being on the ground, and linemen, you know, often will find themselves on the ground after, you know, blocking and bowling somebody over or getting tripped up and such. But, you know, Cyrus in the midst of a play was able to hop right back up, and Ari, when he's down on the ground, it's, you know, send out the rescue squad to pick him up. I mean, he is rolling around, gets on all fours. It's a labor. It's an effort for him to get back on both feet. And I think that's representative of maybe their athleticism. One pops right back up, and one is a construction project.
I also thought it was interesting how we use the tight ends. I just found it interesting of how much we were doing motion with Vogler specifically, but both out to the left flats and out to the right flats. Even Gary Danielson commented on it in the telecast, but when we were watching it in person, we kept commenting about how the tight ends kept being the wide man out, right? When they would do trips to the right or trips to the left. And it seemed like we were doing that to take the wheel linebacker out of the box.
Yep.
Okay. And to force him to go out on the tight end. So when you count the numbers, we had a man to our advantage because they were keeping their safeties deep. And so I just found it interesting, the contrast between the two teams, that LSU was trying to do something. And when they did it, they still had 6-on-6 or 7-on-7. But when we did it on offense, we were able to have a man advantage, which I think had to be something in film study that really helped us inside the box on the run game. Because LSU didn't stack the run is what I mean. There was no 8 guys in the box. We're going to make AJ beat us, right? They're not stupid enough to take that chance. And so I think they said, we're going to try to stop the run with 6 and 7. And they just weren't able to.
And keep the safeties high. And we did do that a lot. And, you know, Danielson did comment that, now he kind of bugged me. His comment was, this is a new look for Alabama. And you know, when I was watching the replay, I said, no, Gary, have you watched any film? You've done some of our games. We do this every week, but we didn't do it as often. We don't do it as often as we did it in this game. And again, it's something that we'll do against an opponent to see how they respond to it. And then, you know, we typically don't get quite the response, the same response, or they don't leave the safety high when we do it. LSU did, so we just kept going back to it. And why not, right?
Oh, sure. And it did frustrate me early in the game when we had Vogler out to the left and we decided to throw that little, you know, pass in the background, pass in the backfield to Christian Jones. And you and I commented to each other that, you know, that's not even a wide receiver missing his cornerback. It's a tight end.
Yeah, I was wondering who was going to bring that up for.
That was so frustrating. Well, it was very, like, come on, man. I mean, he was at the line of scrimmage. How can the tight end not make that block there?
Yeah, he's right there, right? You need to, you should be able to make that block. And you know, it was a freshman DB that he just completely just whiffed on. If he had just held his, you know, his footing, and, you know, he doesn't even have to engage the guy and knock him down. If he just stands in front of him, there is room to run after that completion. And it's frustrating because that would have been, you know, that would have been a first down that we could have used in that situation. We ended up having to, I think, punt on that possession. And so that's frustrating. And, you know, it certainly points out, and I think you've called this before, that, you know, hey, we see this play coming because we've got our physical wide receiver, Christian Jones, out there, and he's nimble and physical enough to make that block. You'd think a tight end could certainly wall someone off, but unfortunately, Vogler had a decent day, but that was a glaring misstep.
It was. I also think we were picking on Jalen Mills. You know, I wish I would have been in the film room to see what they saw there, because we seemed to go at Jalen Mills. I didn't count up the number of times we threw his way, but we definitely decided that, you know, of the two corners, he was who we were going to pick on in this ball game. Kind of like they were picking. Well, I guess I can't say they were picking because they went after Blue as well. But we definitely decided we were going to go Jalen. we definitely decided that we decided we were going to go Jalen Mills' way pretty early in this game. It seemed like.
Yeah, and you know what? Just not to necessarily park on there, but they left him in, and you know, you see where we've had corners picked on this season, and. You know, we'll run a production line through to try to get someone out there that can stop some plays, and they didn't necessarily do that. So that may speak a little bit to the depth between the two units.
No, that's true. Hey, what else jumped out at you when we had the ball on offense?
Well, I like the Yeldon's performance. You know, he had a 133, two touchdowns. You know, 104 of his yards came in the second half, and that speaks to our controlling of the ball in the second half. We actually, our time of possession in the second half was right at 20 minutes, which is pretty darn impressive. I like Drake's explosiveness.
We did not see the rotating during series that we have commented on. There was definitely more. You definitely saw, you know, I guess this is a comment you made in the game about, you know, how we really didn't run as many players out there. Mm-hmm. Drake ended up getting 10 carries for the day, but definitely there was no back and forth. Yeldon definitely got Yeldon was definitely on the field the majority of the time in this ball game, I thought.
No, and to that point, it was like Saban sort of reverts back to, you know, here's my proven method. I like to play a lot of guys when I can. But when we need to shorten the bench or shorten the, you know, that's a basketball term, but when we need to kind of rein in the roster and play a smaller cadre of collection of players, we'll do that. And then we'll play them in the style that he's most comfortable with. And so we kind of went back to I hate to say old school because it was, last year and the year before, but we kind of went back to his previous template for running back rotation. Yeldon didn't come, or Yeldon played the first two, maybe the first three possessions, and Kenyon didn't come in until later. And like you said, we didn't do same drive rotate. Maybe once, I can't remember what, but we didn't do that, you know, as prolifically as we have. And it has been, and it was more of a sort of a two possession to one rotation. And so it was very reminiscent of a couple years ago.
Hey, what did you think about the OJ Howard play?
You're taking all the good ones, man.
Well, okay. No, go for it. No, I'll let you take this one. What on that prior to that play for OJ, and this goes back to me still thinking LSU kind of shot themselves in the foot here many, many times early in this game. But, you know, at the beginning of the second quarter, it's 7-3 and Drake comes in and, you know, he gets a big run for 16 yards and then they get their sack. Yep. And yep. I thought a great play call right after that sack was a screen to Drake. Yep. And so second and 18, you know, he gets 10 of these back and then on third and 8, we went to Amari.
Yep.
And so I'll let you take OJ when you want to. I'll flip it to Amari because I think a sign that Amari is back healthy is that I counted at least twice on third and whatever that we went to Amari and that he was the third down security blanket more so in this game than he has been in any other game this year.
Yeah. I was hopeful that Amari would kind of be the secret weapon in this game. And he never really broke one. He actually came pretty close a couple of times for breaking, you know, long runs after catches, but he couldn't quite slip away. And, we went to him strategically in some key third downs. It looks like he's back. Now, one thing I did notice is after every catch, he rotated out. And we have so many receivers that will do that with a lot of guys. He just seemed more one play in, one play out, one play in, one play out, that we weren't going to push him to the edge of exhaustion or push him to a point of fatigue where maybe he would re-injure himself. We seemed to manage his playing time, but we felt very comfortable going to him. And I feel really good about that. And I'm excited about him getting more and more opportunity.
Oh, sure. I just noticed him. He only finished with three catches on the day, right? Which is pretty pedestrian for him. I just thought it was interesting that I guess more so in this game, it wasn't just Norwood, hey, when I need somebody, it was also Amari Cooper. It was almost like he's getting back to that level with AJ, I thought.
Yep.
So, hey, one of the things that I meant to mention at the beginning of the show, which, you know, I want to do now, is for all the talk, you know, that the media people give all the players and the coaches about, you know, it's just another game and we take it one day at a time and blah, 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 blah. I just thought it was hilarious, you know, Saban jumping in AJ's arms right there at the midfield there at the end of the ball game. And you and I turned to each other and kind of had a chuckle and said, yep. See there? It's just another freaking ball game.
Just another game, right?
I just thought that was funny that it's like, okay, we've been saying all this crap all week that nobody believes, and now we're really showing you that, you know, we were full of crap. Sorry, just had to say that.
Nope, that's fair.
Anything else out at you on offense?
Yeah, you know, I want to hit a couple more things, and I was kind of kidding with you with OJ, but, you know, he had one catch on the day, and we went to him.
Made it count, though.
Yeah, he made it count, right? We went to him a time before and just overshot him, and that would have been a touchdown. But his crossing pattern, you know, 52-yard touchdown, a heck of a run after a catch. You know, Tommy, this is a guy that we've talked about. And, you know, longtime listeners, you know, you've heard us talk about, you know, OJ, him being a star, but
this was his flash.
There is just absolutely zero question. If there was any doubt or any, well, I'm not sure, he's just a freshman. He caught that ball in stride and outran the LSU secondary. I mean, there were safeties and corners that he was pulling away from, and he's a big body tight end. I just thought that was phenomenal. You know, we watched it live and it was very, very impressive. You know, went back and watched the replay several times. You know, even my wife was commenting, wow, he's fast. And it's, you know, it's almost, it, you know, his athleticism has sort of that metric or that, that test that just the casual, you know, observer is recognizing that that guy's good. That's, I think his upside is phenomenal.
Oh, sure. And on that play, and, you know, it makes you wonder in the scouting, it makes you wonder in the scouting report if they just were, you know, if they were underestimating his speed, because the analogy I'll make on that is it's kind of like last year when we played Manziel, right? And you can say the guy's fast, but sure. until CJ took the wrong angle and he outran him, you know, he didn't know how fast he was. And on that play, they, you know, that Jalen Mills kid literally released him to the safety. And then as soon as he released him to the safety, he saw the safety didn't have the angle. Well, it was too late.
It's too late.
Because at this point, he was too far behind. And it was kind of like, oh, the safety can get him. The safety can get, oh, nope, safety can't get him.
Right.
So I thought that was interesting that they played off of him almost like, what's he going to do? He's a tight end. Well, we'll show you what he's going to do.
Yep. And you know, there was another player on a more shallow cross that was open as well. But AJ seemed to have no hesitation. He knew where he was going with that ball, perfectly located it. And then, you know, OJ Howard went to work, and it was a pretty impressive performance.
There was one other thing I wanted to mention to you on offense before you touch on the last thing, is on the touchdown to Christian Jones, you know, where they did fumble the ball on the snap to in the shotgun. That's one of those opportunities that we should have seized that we didn't. And once again, we were picking on Jalen Mills. And so you can't see this in person, but you can see it on the TV. And basically the cameraman zooms in on AJ, and I'm sure you saw this as well, and you can clearly read his lips as to what he says. And he clearly says, why did he turn this way? And so when you watch the route, he took it to the, he literally took it like he was going to run a post instead of going to the pylon.
Yeah.
And that's where he was supposed to go. And if he had gone to the pylon, it would have been an easy touchdown.
Yep. The ball's right there.
And so early in the game, that's why it's like, you know, they had the momentum, because here they are, they fumble the ball and we still can't cash in. So I just wanted to point that out for the listeners that I'm sure they saw it on TV, but Christian Jones, definitely that was his bad on that play.
Yeah. We had a couple of, you know, long passes that, you know, that one could have gone on that. And I think it was actually the same possession that we overthrew OJ. And so we had a couple opportunities there. I think later in the game, we went for a flea flicker, and that did not connect. So we had some opportunities that we didn't cash in on, you know, offensively and defensively. So, you know, so that's certainly true. And I just want to point out also Norwood's touchdown. You know, I did read an article where he was petitioning the coaches for that corner route up until that point in the game, and then they called it and of course, you know, he scores a touchdown. Very athletic play. I thought the coverage on it was pretty good, but it was very athletic, incredible ball placement. You know, I've been thinking about this. I think I'm gonna put together, and I can't do it yet because, you know, there's still plays to be made by Norwood. But I think I'm gonna put something out. You know, my top 10 favorite plays by Kenny Norwood. You know, Kevin Norwood, because, you know, he's the guy that we've talked about for how long about being just an underrated star. And if you start thinking about the things that he's done for us over the years and the spark that he's provided at different points, it's pretty darn compelling. And I think when I put together my top 10 list, that's going to make it.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, one other thing I wanted to mention, too, during the game, you know, right there at the beginning of the fourth quarter, you turned to me and you were calling that we were going to go with a flea flicker there. And so for the listeners, you know, it was only a couple plays later that we gave that a try. And so I thought that was a good call on your point to call that out like that.
I was close on that one. I, you know,
just a couple play. You were just a couple plays off. I truly think that AJ would like to get that one back, because we inserted Kenny Bell in there, and there's that easily could have been seven.
Well, I'll say this, and there's some reality to, you know, this is how close that we're watching and you know, think we kind of sometimes know what's going on. That's a play we might run two or three times a season, and I came within two or three snaps of calling it.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's pretty good.
No, absolutely indeed. Hey, anything else that you got on offense?
I don't think so. I was gonna say, why don't you give us the mini game ball?
You know, that's a tough call because there was a lot of guys that definitely contributed on offense. I guess while we can still call him mini, I'll give mine to OJ Howard.
Okay.
Because he still can technically be mini. And while I'd like to give it to the big uglies, because you know they're probably the reason, you know, AJ had the time he had to make those kind of throws, that was so sweet to watch in person. I'll give it to OJ.
Yeah, I think that's definitely good. And his breakout performance, you know, we talked about Amari and what he did and getting a couple key first downs. You know, he could be a good candidate. I'm going to go with Ryan Kelly. And, you know, he's going to sort of be the representative of the offensive line. But I thought he had a pretty good performance. There were a number of plays where, you know, he would help Chip on, you know, with one of the guards. And then he'd leak out to the second level, collect himself a linebacker. And what I think is most impressive for Ryan Kelly is that he missed so much time in the middle of the season. And you and I have spent some time talking about, would we have brought him back or would we have kind of left things well enough alone with Chad Lindsey? And, we both probably would have stuck with Lindsey if I understand kind of our prior conversations. But the fact that he came in, you know, against Tennessee and then, you know, and obviously here against LSU. And so he's not been back that long. And the offensive line has not missed a beat. And then we go up against a team like LSU, big, big defensive front. And he looks like he has not missed time all season. If you didn't know, you wouldn't know.
No, you wouldn't. And, you know, no offense to him, but I will probably continue to wonder how the game would have gone with Lindsey, because I think Lindsey was playing that well. And when Lindsey did have his opportunity, you know, the story came out that Kelly and Lindsey were, you know, even in August. So,
yeah,
you know, I have to wonder how that game would have unfolded. If I wish I could play a what if, and I wish I could insert number 78 and see how the game would have gone differently.
Yeah. And I'm
no bad, just curious.
No. And I don't think that's a knock on Ryan to, you know, to ask that question. It's more of a credit to Lindsey, because he played so well. And look, we don't have any reporters that cover the team on a regular enough basis that I think have the moxie to, you know, Ian Rappaport would have asked this question, right? And he's working for NFL Network right now, right?
Which is why he would have asked that question.
Which is, yeah, right. And so the question that I would want to ask is, you know, coach, do you ever feel like you have too many good players, and how do you manage that? You know, because you've got Chad Lindsey, who proved that he could be an all SEC caliber lineman, as far as I'm concerned. And you take him to the bench to bring back Ryan Kelly, who's playing, you know, very, very well. Also, you look at the depth that we have at wide receiver, and we've got so many quality wide receivers that there's guys that just don't get a chance sometimes. You know, Kenny Bell, DeAndre White got a couple of balls, but you know, he could be a highlight reel any given week. And we've got four or five guys that any week could have a 100-yard, you know, 100-yard two touchdown week, and none of them do. We've got so many that could do it that none of them do it. And so the question, and that's an elaborated version of the question, but you know, an explanation really, but the question is, you know, do you ever feel like you have too many good players, and how do you manage that?
Yes. No, I agree with that. And it's probably a good problem to have, because
I'd rather have that problem than the other.
Oh, sure. But as long as we've been covering the team in this fashion, We've never had that occur.
No.
Where we've had a player that, man, they probably both would have done just fine.
I can't think of a situation where, now I've had guys that we've recruited that, you know, I like this guy, and so the guy that maybe I've had a personal preference for isn't as good as I thought he was. And so he doesn't get the opportunity to, you know, versus someone else. But where we've had like-kind talent, and they all get a chance to perform, but none of them really puts up superstar numbers because they're distributed. You know, because there's, you know, the piece of bread's too big to cover it all with, you know, peanut butter.
Yes.
I'm done with them analogies for now. Let's flip the field. Hey, you know, one thing, and we called this out to start the game. Chris Black got his first start, his first career start. Now, I don't think he logged a catch. He didn't, you know, he didn't really do anything per se. But, you know, just real quickly, that's the last thing I wanted to get out there is he actually got his first career start. And we've asked ourselves on the podcast this season, you know, because he redshirted last year. He was a guy that we thought was going to, you know, kind of burst from the seams. He went good portions of the season without getting any playing time, not much production. And then now he gets his first start. And so that kind of circles back to, and we got so many guys that we can't even get them all on the field.
No, absolutely. Hey, first thing that jumped out at me on defense is I feel like LSU had success running the ball early. And I think they stuck to that too much because I really think they had a lot of success throwing the ball. I think this game could have been a little closer, had exposed our secondary a little more. Because when you go back and look at these numbers, and we can talk about, you know, Cyrus getting the start, you know, Mettenberger was 16 of 23. And the media wants to talk about the four sacks, okay? But the four sacks is really misleading. Because three of those four sacks came on the last drive when it was 38-17, and you're pinning your ears back, and you know in the fourth quarter that all the kid's going to do is throw the ball.
Yes.
And so defense, kudos to you. But I'm not giving you any big attaboy for the four sacks. In my mind, the offensive line for LSU played pretty well against you, and you got one sack while it mattered. And so for the media that's coming out of this game saying the way to get to Alabama is in the secondary, I still think that's true.
Well, I absolutely think that that's true. Now, I think a couple of things there. I think that they had some early success running. We definitely played more of the Saban base, you know, and, you know, we can talk about what we think the Nicholas of the base versus, you know, Saban says the 3-4. And so we came out more in the 3-4. A lot of, you know, truly, you know, three down linemen, and they did have some success against that. We would walk up some linebackers, but it was primarily, you know, three down linemen. We shifted to more, and we'll play nickel, and we'll go with an alignment of two tackles, a defensive end, and a jack linebacker to really give us a good four-man front and some more beef on the interior. And I think that when we did more of that, we bring Landon up as sort of more of a linebacker in that arrangement, I thought we had more success against the run in that setting. And so that was something that I think slowed down their run, allowed us to slow down the run and still have two safeties high, which I think was good. You know, the first thing I noticed, and it's almost unfair because it's the first thing I'm looking for, and especially in this game, because we didn't know who was going to start the other corner. And so Cyrus Jones starts the other corner. And ironically, Blue is the corner that they go after. And I think they complete at least three passes in the first half against Ballou, and some of them were pretty big gains that helped set up some of their scores. So I thought that, you know, Tennessee, I think, read the clippings that Ballou was hurt and tried to go after him, and that didn't have any impact. But LSU, with their talented bunch of receivers, they went right after him.
Well, they did, and it was interesting on the watching the game replay from being there in person, that Gary Danielson kind of called it when he you know, Landon Collins made a big stop at the line of scrimmage, and he talked about Vinny, and he talked about Landon having to come in for Vinny, and he talked about Landon brought more athleticism at the position, which you and I have talked about. But then he said, is so interesting, the timing of this. He said, but the thing to remain to be seen is the communication in the back end of the secondary. And so on that big pass to Blue in person, you're sitting here thinking, well, Blue just got beat. But then when you go back and watch the replay on the TV, you see that they drug a tight end out in the flats. And now it's a he said, she said, or he said, because Blue's looking back at Landon Collins like, dude, you were supposed to give me help over the top.
Yeah, where's my over the help top?
And Landon Collins is looking like, you know, the camera didn't zoom in on him, but surely he's thinking his responsibility was the tight end. And so, you know, we've broken down the secondary before and the discipline that Saban uses, and the outside corners are supposed to have outside responsibility. Okay. And we've talked about the guys that have written articles about this, that the cornerback's sole responsibility is the guy closest to the sideline. Yep. And so if that's true, then Landon messed up. Because when that tight end covered went to the flats and Deion kind of shaded over that way, my gut is that's what he was supposed to do. My gut is you're the senior. My gut is no offense to Landon, but I think, you know, if we had to put our chips on red or black here, I'm going to put my chips on Blue and take that one off of him and say maybe that was on Landon Collins.
Well, and that's a tough bet because, you know, we heap high praise on Landon Collins for knowing a lot of different positions and whatnot.
Sure. And he played a great game. I'm just saying right there, that might not have been Blue's bag.
Look, I had every opportunity that's true. And what's interesting, you know, and here's sort of the reality. Unless it comes out in an interview, you know, unless the coaches talk about it, we may not know. But here's the takeaway. Is that depending upon, and this is why we talk about defensive backs and sort of the nuance of the game. How, you know, whether the safety's high or not impacts how Blue plays, how he defends the receiver. And so if he thinks he has up top help, his technique is going to differ. Whether he's right or wrong that he should have it, you know, that's almost immaterial. He thinks he has it, and so he plays a certain technique that probably allows the pass to complete. If he knows that he's straight man-to-man, he defends it differently, and maybe it's an incomplete pass.
Yes.
And so I just think that in and of itself, and we'll never know maybe really what the truth of the matter is, but there's a reality that says, I'm going to defend this player differently because I think – because of the technique or because of the defense that I think we're running. And so if he got a miss, you know, was it somebody was wrong, but he played based on it, what he thought was true. And you wonder if he wouldn't have been beat the other way.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, I've got a couple big things on Mosley, but I'm going to save them for the Mosley report. Cause I don't know what you've got from Mosley, but I got some material, man. I'm ready to cover the Mosley report, but I'll hold that for a second.
I do want to say Landon, because I, you know, it's kind of sounds like we're piling on him and you know, hey, I want to be fair. If we think he missed a play, then we need to speak to that. But man, he made some plays too. He made some phenomenal plays. He made a play on Jeremy Hill running outside that if he does not make that tackle, and it may have been a swing pass, but if he doesn't make that play, Hill's rumbling for, you know, 20, 30 yards. And he made a very physical, you know, one-on-one tackle there. And he made numerous, you know, tackles of that sort. You know, his tackles were, you know, we've kind of kidded about, you know, an assisted tackle, and you get a lot of assisted tackles just from being near a play, and it looks like you put up a big number. Landon's were, they were pure. His tackle count is pure.
No, it is. And, you know, I will mention that on the fumble by Copeland on the goal line, that on that play, they took the running back and they motioned him out of the eye into the left flats. And the reason they did that was to take Landon Collins out of the play, in my opinion. And so on that play, they were taking him off the line of scrimmage out of the box. And I guess this is a great time. I want to jump back to Landon a second, but I do want to take a quick second and just comment on Tana Patrick, because we call it straight and we always have. And I have to say that I did not realize exactly at the moment of the play that Patrick had been the one to make the play, but obviously he was in that goal line situation. And so when they drug Landon out of the box, Tana Patrick is the only linebacker on that side. And our defensive end basically bites hard down too much. And had Tana Patrick not been there, he was the only guy there. And so when I went back and watched the replay on the TV, that was probably the play of his career. And I'm just happy for the kid that he can go down making a big play in one of our biggest rivalry, games that we play. And just congratulations to him.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll one up the congratulations, and old habits die hard. So I probably won't carry this through the rest of the season, but for that play, I'll, for my assessment of that play, I'll at least try to say his name right. We've been calling him Tana, but I think it's actually Tanae. And I agree. That was the play of his career. And what's interesting, and we'll talk about this. He's been in on the goal line before, and we've kind of, wonder what's he doing out there. And, Saban has talked about, he plays on the goal line quite a lot. And we talk about, Saban has, there's more than 11 starters. There's the rabbit rusher and the nickel and the dime and all the different formations that he has, that we probably have 15 or 16 different starters. Well, he probably has a special linebacker set on the goal line, because that's when Tanae will come in and play. And you think, well, why would you have him out there? He hasn't been that good of a player. Why would he be out there? And one thing that we'll credit Saban for, and we've spent a great deal of time talking about this, is, Saban will play the person, he'll play the player that gives him the most consistent performance. And, consistent performance at the 50, where you have the whole field ahead of you, might be different, because you're asking players to do different things, might be different than the four things I'm going to ask you to do and key on inside the five, which is where we've seen Tanae. And so he may be the starter at a linebacker position inside the five on the goal line, because in a very tight phone booth space, I know that you're consistently going to do the four things I ask you to do. And that's sort of me assessing, why the heck is he in the field? I think that starts to speak to the reason. And then we see it pay off when he makes a play like that. And actually going back and watching the replay, it looks like Copeland's going to, not only just looks like it's going to score because he's right there, but Copeland is such a big guy. He's 270 pounds, and that might be nice. And the way that Tanae's coming across, he just is consumed. He's blotted out in the largesse of Copeland. And it was a phenomenal play.
It was. And going back to Landon, I wish Landon would have fallen on the ball there instead of, picking it up, just because I think that's the more secure thing to do there at the five. But mm-hmm. but he is the one that recovered the ball. And, just to be clear that we are going to give credit where credit is due, Landon Collins is on every special teams, and we'll cover a unique thing about that here in a minute.
Yeah.
But let's just say that, LSU, after we go up 31-17, LSU has a big kickoff, an 82-yard kickoff to our 18-yard line, of which Landon Collins was in on that big play. And what does he do on the very first play, first and 10, is him and CJ, tackles Jeremy Hill over the right end for a loss of 3 yards. The very next play is where he almost, had the pick six when, he broke up the ball and helped Ballou. And so I just wanted to point out that here's this guy hustling on this kickoff return that doesn't go our way, running, 100 yards one way, 80 yards the other way. He comes in, has to come right back in the game, first and 10 at the 18, and he's responsible for the first two plays that are key on that series.
Yep. You know, one thing I was you know, Landon's a phenomenal player, and he does contribute, you know, in a lot of different ways, and not just, you know, time on the field, but his certainly his play and performance on the field. One thing I noticed, and I didn't notice this during the game because I tend to focus more on our players, and one thing I noticed in watching the replay, and I haven't been able to watch the full replay, but what I saw of it, when Copeland went, you know, when he fumbled the ball, he went to the sideline, and he seemed to sit, you know, very, very dejected. And there was like a team of players and coaches around him trying to coach him up. And one thing I noticed is that he did not come back in the game in the rest of the first half. And it just made me wonder, and I have to, you know, kind of reach out to an LSU, you know, person and kind of see what their perspective is. But it just kind of struck me as maybe there was some fragility there, that when he fumbled the ball, that he just was just too broken up to come back in. And I don't know, that may be too much psychoanalysis, but it struck me that in goal to go situations where you want to have your big fullback in there, he was not in there. And that struck me.
Oh, sure. And obviously the listeners know that, you know, he had a mishap personally.
Yes.
And, you know, he's missed the last 2 weeks with a concussion. And so I was thinking prior to the game, well, lucky us, the fifth year senior, 270 plus pounds fullback, you know, gets to come back in time to play us.
Yep.
I do want to point out, for, you know, while we're on defense, for everything that LSU had go wrong for them early, which is why we started with the difference of opinion, you know, even after we score to make it 31-17, I think a key play on defense was the play by CJ. And the reason I want to mention this real quick is because they picked on Cyrus a ton in this game on the slant pattern. And let me just say that he'll probably get a lot of work in practice on the slant pattern. And even on one play, you know, Ha-Ha comes up and actually motions to, you know, as the game progressed and they started going more and more to the passing side of the calls, Ha-Ha even motioned. I don't know what play sequence it was, but do you remember where Ha-Ha even called up to Cyrus and he even pointed straight ahead, like, watch the cross, you know, watch the slant, it's coming, watch the slant. And then they complete the pass to Cyrus. Yeah. And then the very next play, Ha-Ha says, okay, I'm going to take things into my own hands and I'm going to jump this route and I'm going to put my helmet in his side and I'm going to jar the ball on this third down.
Yep.
So I thought that was a key play for Ha-Ha, that he recognized what was going on. He alerted Cyrus and then he got himself involved.
Yep.
And so I thought that was key. And then the reason I mentioned that to you is because when that game was 31-17 and Landon had just missed that interception, they came back to Cyrus on the very next play, and Cyrus was beat. And when you break down the play, Ha-Ha is in his deep safety, and he goes to blitz. And he goes to blitz, and he passes C.J. Mosley. And Cyrus is beat. And David, had C.J. not got a hand on that ball, they would have scored there, and it would have been a 31-24 ball game.
Yep.
They would have answered that quickly.
That quickly.
And so when you go back and watch the replay, you know, it kind of reminded me eerie of the SEC championship game against Georgia last year. CJ saved a big play there for Cyrus.
Yeah. Yeah. I know we want to get to the CJ, the Mosley report, and he did so much that it's hard to it's hard not to just, you know, delve right into it. I wanted, you know, I guess one more thing that I've got before we do, maybe two, the play of Trey DePriest. We had fun at his expense a couple of weeks ago when he had, you know, I think he had three assisted tackles, and we kind of joked about, you know, what really does that mean and whatnot. But, you know, he had five tackles, a sack, a fumble recovery, and he was laying some licks out there, similar to what CJ did. And Landon, too, it just seemed to be some very physical play. And Trey DePriest really stepped up and I thought asserted himself in the game Saturday, and, you know, hats off to Trey DePriest.
Yeah, because he had to play a lot more, right? I mean, we saw way more him than we did Geno and Jarek.
Yes.
And for this was probably the most, you know, don't know what the snap count was, but this is the most plays he's played all season in a game.
Yep.
And I definitely think he did the most of it. I also want to touch on, you know, Jeffrey Pagan.
Okay.
I think Jeffrey Pagan had a very physical game. You know, I mentioned Ha Ha as well. We could count on several defensive guys that were laying the licks, but I think Jeffrey Pagan really affected the quarterback. They didn't get the sacks until that last series, but he laid some serious licks on Zach in that first half, where Zach got up slow a couple times.
Yeah, we put we hit him a number of times. It was reminiscent to me of, you know, Jordan Jefferson when we had, and those hits all came in a person of Dante Hightower. And we talked about, you know, Jefferson wants no part of playing us again. And then he had his, you know, worst performance of the game in the SEC champion and in the national championship because, you know, he was hearing footsteps because he got planted by Hightower a number of times. And I think Mettenberger probably has more mental resolve. And so he wasn't afraid of getting the hits and wasn't afraid to step back up and stand in there. But darn if he didn't take some licks too, though.
No, he did. And it goes back to, you know, I mentioned earlier about the sacks and the media making something about the four sacks. The reason I wanted to point on Pagan real quick and say that is because while we got those sacks at the end, and so the media is being short-sighted when they just, sure, you know,
you look
talk
at the
about
number
the four sacks.
Yeah,
that's the lazy analysis that you and I talk about. Is I think the bigger thing this speaks to is Saban saying it's not about the sacks. It's about affecting the quarterback. And I think when he stepped back as the game progressed, it was a little different for him.
Yep.
And what was the other things you want to touch on there before we jump to the Mosley report that I've already kind of started?
Well, I think I think the defensive line as a whole, we did talk about Pagan. I'm glad I brought him up, but you know, just to kind of give a tip of the hat to the other, you know, primary players on the DL. I thought Ivory played well. He had a couple of sacks, and Robinson didn't necessarily, you know, ring up a lot of metrics, but I thought his play was stellar.
He was in Zach's face a couple times.
Yeah, he really was. You know, didn't see a lot of the younger guys. Jonathan Allen was in there a little bit. Didn't see any of D-Liner. And so we'll have to keep a close eye out for him because we did strip the red shirt. You know, one player that I want to spend just a minute on, and you know, again, the lazy analysis might speak to, you know, some decent stats because, you know, he had one of the sacks and he had a tackle for loss. But I found myself being disappointed in the play of Adrian Hubbard. He seemed stiff. He didn't seem to bend the knees, and he lost containment a couple of times
early in the game on that big play on the right side.
Yes,
yep.
Early, you know, I just remember, you know, just barking out, you know, you can't let him get outside of you. You're the outside guy. You can't let him get outside of you. And he just seemed so stiff and not able to move, you know, with the fluidity, frankly, the fluidity that we've seen from him before. So I don't know if there's an injury, I don't know, but I just saw Adrian Hubbard not play very well. And so everyone's going to call him, you know, a hero because he had a sack, but I was not pleased with his performance.
I didn't feel like he played with the intensity that we have seen him play with before.
Yeah.
And what I will say is that coming into the season, I expected him to be one of those guys that was just making plays all over the field.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's the best way I can say it.
Mm-hmm.
And how we're talking about Landon Collins is how I thought we'd be talking about Adrian Hubbard.
Yes.
Relevant to the position that he plays.
Yes. Yes. Agreed.
And that has not been the case.
Agreed. Agreed. Well, pour some Mosley report on me.
Well, man, I just wanted to, you know, I've already touched on that big deflection because that was huge because that could have made it a 7-point game again. But there was a big tackle for loss that he made that was also a big momentum thing where I didn't realize in person that he had beat three guys. until I went back and watched it on tape.
Yep.
But I'm curious if we saw something on film about the gap between the center and the left guard.
Yes.
Because on the play where he had the big tackle for a loss, when you go, I mean, the camera angle was great by CBS because it was right behind the defense and you could see the gap between the right guard and the center versus the left guard and the center. And the left guard gap was like twice as big. And so on that play, I remember telling my wife when I was going back and watching this replay, I was like, I probably could have gotten the backfield.
Yep.
Because literally he timed it up to the line of scrimmage. And the reason I point this out is because Trey DePriest did it and CJ did it during the game.
Yes.
And they both did the same gap. But on this play, he hits the gap. He times it perfectly, which makes me think they weren't altering their snap count. Then he misses the wide receiver who's coming in motion to try to that could have blocked him. And then the fullback misses him. And so he literally scoots by three guys and makes the play in the backfield. And so when you watch it on film, it's even more freaking awesome than in person.
Yeah. You know, normally, you know, you think of, man, that hole was so big that, you know, I could have run through it. You think of that's a good thing that the offensive line has done. You know, it almost, you know, want to break down those specific plays and see if there's some consistency across the look that they were given, that we knew that when we see this look, they're going to block it in this way. They're going to double team down in this way, and we'll be able to take advantage of it. You know, what consistencies were there? What was there in those plays?
And it could have just been more of in film, right? The coaches spotted this and said, Trey, CJ, every play, I want y'all to check these stances.
Yeah.
And if it looks like you can hit it, hit it.
Yep.
And twice it did, and it worked. So. Yeah. That was the other thing I wanted to mention for, because obviously you can obviously look at the stat line and you can see that he had a phenomenal ball game. But to me, we had just had the OJ Howard touchdown. We had just taken the lead 10-7, and he makes that big play, which was huge in the first half. But then that second play in the second half with that deflection, I you know, could have sealed the game for us, because at that point it protected a 14-point margin.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, his 12 tackles, you know, seven of them were solo, and they were physical tackles. You know, he was getting after people and really bringing them down, you know, with some aggression. And one point that, you know, I thought was interesting is, you know, you think about last year, he didn't get as many snaps against LSU. And, you know, last year he split time at that position, especially when we were in the Saban base with Nico Johnson. And, you know, we like Nico, and he's, you know, he's a fantastic player, having, you know, a good rookie season. But CJ brings more athleticism to the position. And so he had the opportunity this year against LSU to make plays that in prior years he just didn't have the opportunity because he wasn't on the field for those snaps. And, you know, you take a game where, you know, like this, when we're in the base more often, he's getting more snaps than, you know, he otherwise normally would. And it's an opponent where we keep our starters in. We go with a shorter bench for the duration of the game. You see what kind of stats he really can rack up. And so you think, gosh, if we played closer games, he would be a household name, not just amongst the Alabama fans, not just across our listeners, but nationally, he would be a household name if we weren't so good of a team.
Yeah, that's true as far as CJ. And not only did, you know, he not get to play as much last year because of Nico, but, you know, he's the same guy that Bama fans remember got hurt in the national championship game the year prior against LSU. So the last two times that they've played this team, he hasn't really got to be on the field this much. And so there was probably some extra motivation for CJ in this game.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree that he wanted to go out and make a statement, and most assuredly he did. Anything else you got on defense, or you want to give us your mini game ball?
You know, I'll just mention the play of Jarek Williams.
Yeah.
I just want to comment that, you know, there's all this been talk about Geno and Geno and Landon getting the time with Saban when Vinny went out, et cetera. And, you know, take nothing away from Geno. Geno just wasn't on the field very much. We didn't have six DBs in the game very much, which I think is his role right now. And so more times than not, when we were the two cornerback three safety look. And the three safeties, it seems like our comfort zone has gone to Jarek, Ha-Ha, and Landon. And Landon has assumed Vinny's role at the line of scrimmage, and Jarek has been there back with Ha-Ha. And it seems like we've run more two deep safety in the past couple weeks than just one deep safety. And when you, every time I look in the back of the defense before the snap, I see Jarek Williams beside Ha-Ha. And so, and then when it's time to, you know, to blitz one of those safeties, we're blitzing Ha-Ha and we're giving Jarek that deep responsibility. Yep. And so Saban seems comfortable letting him be your safety valve over the top.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Jarek's a guy. And I feel that we've done a good job in giving him credit. I don't think I've read a single article about him all season, but I feel like, you know, between the two of us, he's gotten two or three mini game balls. We've talked about his performance coming in, stepping in for Geno. We thought that was just, you know, going to be a couple of week deal, but man, he's turned it into a season long experience. And so hats off to Jarek.
Absolutely. Well, who do you, I'll start with you, man. Who gets your mini game ball in defense?
Well, you know, I give it to Tanae for the reasons that we've talked about, and we've had a couple of people even, you know, kind of write in, you know, someone hit us up on Facebook, someone hit us up on email, sort of the write-in candidate for Tanae. I think you got to give it to him for, you know, for that strip of the ball at the goal line, you know, very easily. I don't know necessarily that the outcome of the game would have changed, but certainly the experience of the game would have changed had they scored that touchdown. That would have given them a lot more confidence. They wouldn't have gone to the passing game, you know, quite as much. They wouldn't have become as one dimensional. So I think the game changes materially if they score that touchdown. And so I give my nod to Tanae for that.
Yeah, I've got to concur with that from a mini game ball as far as giving Tanae the nod there for the reasons that we've stated. You know, I didn't realize till I went back and watched some of the replay that Gary Danielson mentioned that in the previous five matchups between these two teams, there's been no touchdown scored in the first quarter. And so now that streak, you know, stretches out to six games. And so I thought that was interesting little stat that now the last six times these two teams have played each other, because of that strip, you know, it protected that streak to go to six games with no touchdown in the first quarter.
Yeah. I, you know, and I think that, that's true. I think the, you know, the final score, the 38-17, I think it's, you know, maybe ironic that, you know, 21 is the margin, and that's what we beat them in the national championship. So that has to sting the LSU fans a little bit. I was kidding that the only difference between this 21-point margin and that 21-point margin is they crossed the 50 this time.
Yes.
And that's not the difference, obviously, but it makes for a good line.
No, it does. Absolutely. At least they can say that the process for them continues and they're making marginal improvement against us.
Indeed. Talk to me about special teams.
Man, I have, you know, the saying, the floor is yours. Well, I'm going to let you start on this tirade. Go ahead and you know, let me set it up for you if I can. Okay. Because Gary Danielson did our homework for us. And so at the beginning of the telecast, you know, when they're showing Chris John Jones, they comment that his current kickoff return average of 32.7 yards leads the NCAA. And this is where we just keep it so real on this show, because we have talked so glowing about him this year and how meaningful he is and how tough a competitor is. All that doesn't change. But I don't know if he just let that stat go to his head or what. I mean, tell the listeners, man, how do you think he did returning kickoffs in this ball game?
Well, it was atrocious. I don't think we returned any of our kickoffs, you know, for the game across the 25. You know, to start the game, he and I don't know if it's the start of the game, one of the first kickoffs of the game, he is, you know, three quarters of the way to the back of the end zone, has to leap into the air to catch the ball.
Very first kickoff.
And yep. and brings it out, you know, wherever he brings it out, there's a penalty. And so we start the drive, you know, right at the 10, you know, 13, whatever yard line. And my frustration is they'll give you the damn ball on the 25. They'll give it to you there for free. And so yes. Why, when the ball is going to go out of the end zone, would you not take free? Why would you not take a quarter of the field for free? And what it made me, you know, I started to wonder, you know, how does that change our play calling when we're in the shadow of our end zone there versus, you know, being at the 25? How does that impact our play calling? And not only, you know, and so the first play is the run that Yeldon has that gets us right back out to the 25. And so you think, well, I don't know, maybe it doesn't change the play calling. But what if you're at the 25 and you get that 12-yard gain? And
now so you're at the 37. Yeah.
And so you kind of play through, well, we punted from our 40. And so you think, well, we started on the 10, and if we get the ball on the 25 – if we're at the 40, we're at the opposite 45, and maybe we're playing, you know, we're calling plays a little differently, you know, if only to set up for a field goal. It just makes me wonder, you know, how does this drive unfold differently if we've not backed ourselves in the corner? And we did that a couple times. You know, DeAndre White brought one out, you know, to the 22, and you think, well, you know, good for him. He gets 22 yards of production, but as a team, we're -3. And it's kind of, you know, I don't want them to do this, and they would never do this. But if we lined up on the 22, it was 1st and 13, people would stop doing that crap. And there's a part of me that looks at it that way because we're leaving yards on the table. Now, look, you're going to run one back for a touchdown, and, you know, people is going to say that nullifies my entire argument. I don't know that it does. I don't know that it does, you know, because if it's in the end zone, don't bring it out of the end zone. You know, if it's on the 5, you know, if it's on the 8 or 9 and you've got some run, well, then that's different. But because you're going to be tackled there, they're not going to, if you're tackled at the 8 or you kneel at the 8, they're not going to bring it out to the 25. You're at the 8. And so maybe you try to return that one. But when you're leaping up into the air to catch it from going out of the back of the end zone, maybe you don't return that one.
No, and to be fair, because thank goodness they only scored 17 points, and so they only kicked off the ball 4 times. And I'm glad you mentioned DeAndre White, because to not pick on Christian solely, they each did it twice. And so when you go back and look at the stat line, you know, DeAndre White had 2 kickoffs returns he made, the longest being 22 yards, and Christian Jones got to return the other 2, and his longest one was 21 yards. So both of them left yards on the table.
Yeah, so there you go.
Hey, the thing I want to touch on special teams is Landon Collins and specifically kickoffs, because, you know, it's been really apparent how much of a headhunter he's been in the middle of kickoffs for several weeks now. And for the past 2 weeks now, between the Tennessee game and now after the bye week LSU, both of these teams have decided to double team Landon Collins running down the middle of the field, and he's the only guy that gets doubled out of all the guys covering the kick. And 2 weeks in a row, this poor guy has had to go against double coverage, you know, a double block on every kickoff down the whole field. And I have to say it has been successful, because he has not made a tackle in the last 2 games on kickoff coverage.
Well, and not only has he not made a tackle.
The whole team has not made a tackle.
and the Tennessee game, I probably would have called it a fluke. You know, now we've had two instances of it. It's been the worst coverage performance that we've had
all season. And so, yes,
if Tennessee kind of, well, let's double one of them and see how it worked. Well, it worked pretty well. And LSU said, well, heck, if that works, we're going to do it too. LSU,
and they knew which one to double. And they knew which one to double.
Yeah, they knew. Yeah, yeah. It wasn't random, right? And so LSU almost had them a touchdown. Tennessee certainly had some good return yards against us. So I think we've got to, you know, and so here's what we need to watch for, right? And here's what we need to, you know, have people watch for is, let's see if we move him around a little bit. Let's see, you know, how we do to counteract that. If we're going to leave them in the same place, they're going to practice all week that the guy in this slot is who we're double teaming. That, you know, let's move them around a little bit and see if we can't shake them free.
Well, and to your point, right? Because this is the second game we've done this. And so, to your point, the up guy for LSU in the middle and the first back got back the next level, the second row there in the middle. They're the two, right, who did this with Landon Collins. Mm-hmm. And to your point, had we put him somewhere else at the start of this game and the two middle guys had been practicing this all game, it would have been interesting to see how that, you know, how that unfolded.
Yep.
Hey, also thought it was interesting that once again, you know, Cade Foster comes back, you know, from his being banged up and being kicked in the shin, and he handles the majority of the duties and had a good field goal. But Cody Mandel gets one of the kickoffs again. I understood why we did it 2 weeks ago, but I didn't understand why we brought Cody out there to do one of the kickoffs in this ball game.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for that. You know, while we're mixing it up, you know,
and Griffith, no, by the way, right? No Griffith like we normally see, but just Cody. And so Cade Foster kicks off six, and Cody kicks off one. Why is that?
You know, the only thing I can think of is, you know, he's a good tackler.
Maybe Cade had to go use the restroom or something, and we just didn't see it. I mean, that's the only thing I can think.
I don't know. I do not have a legitimate even attempted explanation on that. We've got to do something to get the darn ball in the end zone. Then, you know, and so if we're mixing it up for that purpose, I don't know. We seem to struggle. Griffith is the one that seems to most consistently be able to put it in the end zone. But if we're not letting him kick it, then I don't. You know, you got me on that one.
Hey, anything else on, because I didn't get a chance to go back and break down that kickoff return of theirs as much as I would have liked. I noticed on Reggie Ragland's push in the back at the beginning of the game, he did that push in the back, you know, past, he was behind the play.
Yeah.
He doesn't know it at the time, but obviously his push in the back wouldn't even have affected the play. So that was an unfortunate miscue. But anything else you noticed in special teams? I mean, I guess we need to spend a couple minutes talking about the fake punt. You know, some of the guys around us felt like that was coming, you know, after we had called the timeout. Were you surprised that we structured the play the way we did, where CJ, you know, in for Vinny now, hands off the ball to Jarrett Williams of all people?
Yeah. See, there's a whole life, you know, to that fake. You know, you look at the ball, you know, at our 41, it's just unexpected enough to be expected, you know, very short yardage in that situation. You know, we call a timeout, and I think that kind of works against, you know, oh, should we expect it here or not? Well, surely they're not going to do it just right after a timeout. That would be too obvious. And Cody, you know, takes a practice swing, you know, kind of kicking the ball, and punters will do that so often, you know, sometimes. And so he did that, and CJ was there, and Cody was pointing down to the field. And I was like, that's a little over the top. Why is he pointing down the field? Like, oh, I'm going to point it over there. You know, why would you do that? And it just seemed, every component of it seemed so, you know, in hindsight, it's 2020, but every single component of it seemed so scripted. Well, they're not going to fake it. He's back there, you know, warming up his leg, and he's pointing out, you know, a coverage kind of scheme, you know, and of course we do fake it. And what was, and you mentioned this, and this to me is what stands out the most. And here's maybe a little bit of genius in the construct of that play, is we didn't have a running back, or it wasn't a receiver. It wasn't a skill, you know, what you would consider a skilled hands person. It was a snap to Mosley and a handoff to Jarrett Williams
for his first carry of his career.
First carry, you know, is, and so you think, the, you know, he's got defensive players back there. Of course,
the majority of defensive players. Yes.
And so you think, well, if you had a running back there, you might think that, you know, that's the skill set you're looking for, but nope. Linebacker and a safety, and that's who we execute with. I thought it was pretty well, you know, executed, and so you look for, like, what's the the ensemble cast you might see in like a TV show or a movie. That was an ensemble performance there, with the punter having a role and the defensive players and the timeout, and it just seemed mighty orchestrated. And it was, you know, so almost over orchestrated that if you really thought they were going to fake it, well, they're, of course, they're not going to fake it after all that nonsense. And then that's when we fake it.
Oh, absolutely. I did not think at that point in time at the 40-yard line that we would call that. And so when our colleague behind us mentioned that he thought that was what was about to occur, I definitely, you know, was sitting here thinking, no, I don't think Saban's going to do that. You know, we got a close ball game here, and we want field position, and you know, we want to flip the field. And I was definitely surprised, as was, you know, I was just as surprised as the LSU nation that's what he called there.
Yeah, and at first I thought, well, this might be a position to do it. And then after all of the other, I thought, no, we're not going to do it now. And then we did. And so I kind of got, you know, pulled into that as well. So I thought that, and what's, you know, and here's what's compelling, and here's why people will say that this is the play that flipped the ball game, because that fake punt happened in the midst of a 14 play drive, a 79 yard drive, an 8 minute drive that ended in a touchdown. So 14 play, 79 yard, 8 minute touchdown scoring drive. And you think, well, that was sort of the pivot point of at least of that drive. And so you can see where people would easily sort of make that the pivotal play of the game. I can see the connective tissue there.
No, I'm with you there. I just
think it's more to it than just one play.
Yes, absolutely. Hey, anything else on special teams for you?
I'm just going to go tip of the hat to Cade Foster, 41-yard field goal against – hey, look, they're a high-quality opponent. You don't know how the game's going to unfold. You know, they're having some measure of success. You know that they're going to, you know, let's kick this. You know, we're up by three, which is a fragile number. You know, hats off to him, because that's as much of a pressure kick as he's had this season.
Well, and he's only missed one on the year, right?
Yeah.
So he came into this game 9 out of 10, and now he's 10 out of 11. So that's, you know, that's pretty impressive.
No, his confidence is definitely gaining, and so, you know, to the extent maybe that we've managed that, I don't know how much you can, but to the extent that, you know, he's built up some confidence, and so in this game when we need him to kick, and so maybe that can bode well for the games that we have left, is that, you know, he's got to be riding as much confidence as he possibly can, you know, at least at this stage of the season. So that's good. That's good. I just give hats off to Cade because we have openly questioned what we might get from him. And, you know, so far I'm happy to be wrong.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, anything else on special teams before we talk about some Mississippi State?
I don't think so, man. Let's talk about the Dogs.
Well, man, you know, this is a very different Mississippi State team than we're used to seeing as far as this point in the season. I mean, they come in at 4-5, you know, with only one win in the SEC. And let's face it, that was, you know, at home, they beat Kentucky by 6 points.
Right.
And so, you know, this is just a very mixed bag to me, because we know how we did against Kentucky. You know, they play a Kentucky team. They lose 28-22. LSU, you know, handled them 59-26. And then they turn around against Texas A&M, which we know has no defense. And, you know, they put up 41 points last week in a loss. So I look at these rankings and they, you know, they come into this game very highly ranked as far as offensive categories. But I think there's some fluff there because, you know, of who they've played as far as the defense opponents. And so, you know, I think their record is pretty indicative of what we're going to see. I think this is a team that, you know, is struggling to find an identity. Yep. And, you know, it was a close game 2 years ago in Mississippi State. I mean, it was 24-7, and, you know, it's always closer when we play, you know, with all the cowbells. But I just don't see them putting up much of a fight in this ball game.
No, and I like the way you worded that they're, you know, struggling to find an identity. I was going to call them a schizophrenic team, you know, because they should have beat Auburn. You know, you could reason that, you know, they should have beat Auburn. They should not have been so close to Texas A&M, right?
Right.
And that's a game that, you know, they're going to draw confidence from that, you know, because, you know, A&M has a little bit of a reputation now. And so that's something that they're going to feel good about in a season that has been disappointing for them. You know, we played them last year. They were 7-0 you know, weren't that good. This year they're, you know, would you say they were 5-4 or
4-5 coming into this game? Yeah,
4-5, and they may not be that bad. So it's, you know, it's kind of hard to measure. Playing them in, at their place is, I think, always tough. They're a big, tough physical team. You know, I kind of kidded at the beginning of the season, what is our toughest stretch of the season? And so the first three teams, you know, proved to not really be an obstacle. I'm not suggesting that Mississippi State's a threat to beat us, but they're a physical team at their place. I think if we come out, you know, complacent, then they'll hit us in the jaw. I see this being a 38-7. I don't think we score as many points. I think they do score a touchdown, probably early. I could see it being, you know, 14-7 early. But I think we pull away, and I think we beat them.
Yeah, I agree. This is a team that in years past, you know, they were the bruising team of just trying to run it down your throat. The stat that jumped out to me in researching them is they are ranked fourth in the NCAA in time of possession. You know, they'll come into this game against Alabama, you know, having the ball an average of 33 minutes per game. And so obviously their MO in this ball game is they're rushing for over 200 yards a game. But offensively, you know, they're putting up 450 yards and they're able to hold the ball. And so if they hold the ball 33 minutes like they've been averaging, well, then this is going to be a much closer game. But fortunately, I see us being able to shut this rush down early and put the pressure solely on the quarterback. I don't think this is going to be quite as close as it was 2 years ago, 24-7. So I could see this being like a 31-7 type of ball game.
Yep. Yeah, I think we're going to come out a little, I won't say lackadaisical, but we're going to come out less motivated for this game. There's going to be a little bit of letdown after LSU. I think this is, like we said, this is a team that can hit you in the mouth, and I think we'll respond to that, but I think we'll get hit in the mouth first, and, we'll taste our blood and then,
get ticked off by it.
and then get ticked off. That's really what I see happening, and it'll be frustrating. You know, because we know that's going to happen, but I think that we know what'll happen next. And so that'll we'll just sit there just shaking our heads as it happens.
Absolutely. Well, man, that's all I've got this week.
I want to hit a couple of the five-star reviews. We appreciate getting those. We want to ask for more. We're up to 39, and so our goal is to get to 50 by the end of the season. So, man, if you're still listening, then you must like what we're putting out here. Go to iTunes and give us a review. But I just want to hit a couple of these real quick. We've gotten two new ones. Real Big Tink. I don't know what that means, but they like the podcast. These guys understand the game of football better than any others I've come across. If you want to be entertained and educated at the same time, this show is for you. So we greatly appreciate that. And then McKenna Plays MC gave us the review. I've been listening to Tom and Dave for a few years now, and they are awesome. If you are looking for Alabama football talk that goes deeper than the norm, you have to subscribe to this podcast. They are very insightful and give you tidbits you won't get anywhere else. I love the weekly mini game ball awards. And so that's awesome. I don't think that I could have written any better
than you did that. You did a good job paying him for that comment.
I'm
good
telling
job.
You, I really like. No, I tell you what I like is I really like that they like the mini game balls, because I think in some ways that kind of encapsulates what we're trying to do. Right? Is talk about the game and talk about what we see, but talk about the things and emphasize some of the things that are not on everyone's headline. And so what are sort of the nuances, you know, and so we don't always do that, and we kind of slip away from that. But we try to talk about the nuances that aren't making, you know, the all of the headline kind of highlights. And so I like that that people are listening and specifically appreciate that as something that we're trying to do.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, hey, this has been another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. We appreciate you tuning in, and roll tide.
Thanks for listening to the Alabama Football Podcast. We love that you're tuned in and hope that you enjoyed the show. We encourage you to reach out and let us know what you like, where we can improve, or just a shout out, a roll tide. We are where you are. iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, email newsletters, t-shirts, free roster downloads, and of course, on the web at alabamafootballpodcast.com. Check us out where you'll find easy links to your favorite way to follow the tide. Got that, coach?
Aye.
Of course. Roll Tide.